Thank you, that was beautiful as always. There was an interesting cartoon in a magazine which shows a smiling little character striding vigorously forward. And the caption underneath was, "I am what's happening." And more than we know, this may be true of all of us. We are often asked if divine science is a religion. And the answer is both yes and no. Divine science is not a theology that anyone must accept in total without question. It is not a set of creeds to be memorized and repeated by rote. It is not a liturgy of formal rites and ceremonies. Divine science is a spiritual teaching that deals with attitude and the levels of thinking and feeling, or what we call consciousness. The idea that you are a spiritual being with the power built right into your very nature to unfold your imprisoned true self, and that you do not have to be a victim of circumstances. You always have a choice to react in resistance or to choose the high road of love and non-resistance. This teaching stresses that you may not be able to change things, you may not be able to change people, but you can always change your thoughts about them. As Solomon said, "For as he thinketh in his heart, so is he." Consciousness is the key. It is the one word religion. Now, this word, consciousness, is frequently used in truth teachings and often ambiguously. The word really cannot be acceptably defined, and yet without it, nothing else in life can be definitely defined. You are a spiritual being in potential, living for the most part in human consciousness, in the process of becoming what you really and truly are. At present, you are aware of yourself somewhere on the path of evolution between the human and the divine. This level of awareness is your consciousness. For this reason, because of consciousness, you are capable of either beastliness or saintliness. In other words, your central I will be modified as possessive and cruel, or as inspired and saintly. In his Terum Organum, Ospensky deals with the role of consciousness through what he calls the center of gravity. He says that the center of gravity of everything shall lie for humans in their inner world and not in the outer world at all. He says that at first aim we can have regarding our development is to create in ourselves a permanent I to protect us from continual striving, from moods and desires that sway us. This seems to mean that we should identify ourselves at a point in consciousness above the wellness-sustaining level. The point is what Ostensky calls the center of gravity. In the Garden of Eden allegory found in Genesis, after Adam and Eve disobeyed God and ate the forbidden fruit, they hid themselves, for they were ashamed. And God called out, "Adam, where art thou?" Now, this was not a vindictive God seeking out Adam for punishment, not at all. Adam and Eve were created whole, spiritual beings. But but they lost their strongly rooted center of gravity. Theology calls this the fall of man. Actually, it was the fall of their level of consciousness. We are told that they covered themselves, that they were naked. They covered their nakedness because they became centered in a physical consciousness. The word that we have translated as where in the allegory is the Hebrew word ahi, which means what, where, whence, and how. So more than likely, God was challenging Adam to look to his center of gravity, asking him, "Who are you? What is the level of your center of gravity? What is the focus of your consciousness?" If Adam had answered aright, they would not have been forced to leave Eden, and there would not have been the so-called fall. It is important to deal with the story of Adam and Eve as an allegory that has a metaphysical meaning and is applicable to each and every one of us personally. God did not drive them out of the garden. They simply lost their spiritual focus. They lost their sight of the kingdom of God potential within them, and like the prodigal son, had to find their consciousness level and work their way back. This is the constantly recurring theme of the stories in the Bible. The other extreme is found in the gospel when Jesus asked Peter, "Who do they say that I am?" And Peter answered, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter was not seeing the Christ in Jesus. He was seeing from an awareness of the Christ in himself. In personal symbolism, this is the Lord of our being asking, "Where are you?" And it is answering in faith, "I am whole." All of the religions of the world teach that we cannot find integration as whole persons as long as we are sense-oriented. Metaphysically, the Bible uses the symbols of the Israelites enslaved in Egypt. Moses represented the ascending urge that leads them to the promised land. Before we awaken to even the tiniest degree of spiritual understanding, our attention is centered out there in a whirling circle of life and experience at the basest level. Symbolically, the Israelites were in bondage to a completely limited view of what they were. In this consciousness, we remain dead to any living experiences of our divine potential. We need to follow the Moses urge to awaken, to remember, to know the truth. We refer often to the need to expand our consciousness, and this means broadening our awareness. Nothing really changes, only our perception. Everything in our life responds to the way in which we see ourselves. There are two famous drawings used by Gestalt psychologists to test students. One is a picture of an old witch-like woman, and the other is a picture of a rabbit. But if you look at the woman long enough, she turns into a pretty young woman wearing a boa. And if you look at the rabbit long enough, it turns into a duck. If you continue to look at them, they reverse themselves again. Now, what is the reality of the drawings? Well, there is no single reality. They will always be exactly what you see them as being. The revealing thing is where you are, the viewer, in consciousness. If there is a pattern of poverty in you, which means that your center of gravity is below all sufficiency and all things level, then you will see everything from a poverty perspective. You will see lack everywhere, and you will experience lack in all of your affairs. But if there is a sense of affluence, a sense of healthy child of God entitled to abundance consciousness, you will see all things from this perspective, and you will experience abundance in all your affairs. This is what is referred to as a prosperity consciousness. And so it is with healing, with justice, and with human relationships. Our level of consciousness, the way we see and feel, makes all the difference. Researchers in the field tell us that 85% of all illnesses are psychosomatically induced, and 85% of all accidents are unconsciously invited. So when you cry out, "What on earth is happening to me?" your consciousness is revealing, "I am what's happening to me." Ralph Waldo Trine says that within each of us lies the cause of whatever comes to us, that no disease can enter or take hold of our bodies unless it finds there something corresponding to itself that makes it possible. It is a fundamental truth, but admittedly, it is a very hard one to accept. This does not mean that if you catch a cold, it is because you have been thinking cold, cold, cold. It is simply that your center of gravity, or your focus of your central eye, is below the wellness-sustaining level. Believing in illness, our natural bodily resistance forces become neutralized, and we become susceptible to illness. The principle is, consciousness precedes experience. And so it is, and so it follows. Change your consciousness, and you change your experience. It may be well the greatest discovery in the past 2,000 plus years. The idea that consciousness makes life what it is, and that I am always what's happening to me. As consciousness changes, so life changes. An important key to changing consciousness is changing how you see. It is often said, seeing is believing, but this is not entirely correct. Most accurately, we should say, believing is seeing. When trying to understand the idea of consciousness, it is good to remember that you live in the world of your mind. Things exist. Experiences happen for you as you see them. This is why we say that when you pray for others, heal your concern about them first. In other words, you are primarily dealing with your image of that other person, and unless you change the image, you will actually be supporting their illness, even if you are repeating over and over and over healing affirmations. Dr. John Dorsey, a Detroit psychiatrist, in his book, Living Consciously, The Science of Self, makes the point that you can only be conscious of yourself. You cannot be conscious of some other person, for every kind of other is nothing but your own living of it. It is part of who you are. It's an interesting concept of perception. It may help you to avoid the trap of, "But the problem is not in me. The problem is out there. It's in him. It's in her. Or it's in them. Or it's in that other thing." This is what you may refer to or call otheritis. Actually, all things begin in consciousness, not in hers, not in theirs, not in his, but in mine. So, whenever you are experiencing problems with conditions out there, it is good to imagine God calling to Adam, "Adam, where are you?" And to remember, "I am what's happening." Do you remember back in the day the fun houses at the amusement park? Can you remember walking down a hallway through the farther end of which you saw someone approaching you, and until you suddenly bumped into yourself in a mirror? In the great funhouse of life, the inescapable conclusion that everyone must sooner or later come to is that we constantly bump into ourselves. If you have problems in business, you must realize that one major problem is ourselves. If you marry and walk hand in hand into the land of happily ever after, then have difficulty sustaining the love in the relationship and maintaining a happy home, the problem is with ourselves. In Jesus' parable of the prodigal son, the young man sitting among the swine in the far country came to himself. It is the one thing that always brings us up short. The poet had a dream in which he was ruined by a veiled figure. He dreamed that he had made a fortune, and the veiled figure snatched it from him. He achieved fame, and the veiled figure turned it into disgrace. He dreamed that the veiled figure frightened him in bed, spoiled his taste of his food, and on his wedding day it stopped the mouth of the priest crying, "I cannot support the bands." "Who are you?" cried the poet, tearing away the veil. Lo, the face of the stranger was his own. As Shakespeare so wisely observed, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. The key to Shakespeare's greatness as a dramatist was that he knew that life's greatest tragedies lie within ourselves, the failure to take control of our lives. Hamlet wrestled with his own hesitant, shocked, and indecisive soul. Macbeth with his own ambition and remorse, and Othello with his own insatiable jealousy. These great characters were having it out with their own souls. One man had a very successful career in the business world. He started out as a paper boy, and through the years he has become a very successful and a very wealthy man. It wasn't the result of a formal education, nor did he inherit any wealth. In fact, his father died when he was very young, and he had to quit school to help provide for his family. He says he has but one secret, and that secret is, you either run or get run. It was his way of saying that he has always taken charge of his life, mainly through careful control of his mind and his emotions. He simply does not let people or conditions or circumstances or the news of the day decide how he is going to think, how he is going to feel, or how he is going to act. It is so sad to see that many people are dominated by their fears or feelings of inferiority and by all the negatives that flow unchecked into their minds from the world around them. And so it is that they are run by what their neighbors think and what their neighbors do, by the news of the day, by the current changing conditions, and by their fear of the future. Most of these people are better educated and began life with far greater prospects than the successful man. They had every right to expect their dreams and their aspirations to be fulfilled. But they probably have not made the discovery that they can take charge of their lives and have a large say in their destiny. Thoreau says, "The mass of men live lives of quiet desperation. And the reason is, they think that they are the pawns of fate, that things are as they are, and, well, what are you going to do about it?" It is a great moment in life when you make the discovery that things may happen around you and things may happen to you, but the only thing that has any relevance is what happens in you. You may have little or no control over the elements or the fluctuations of the stock market or even the unpredictable behavior of the people in your immediate world, but you live in a world of consciousness. And you can always control what happens in your mind. As I said, it's not easy, but you can take charge of your life. To some people, the idea of controlling thought is like trying to control the movement of the sun. They think that thought is a spontaneous reaction to conditions. Something happens and they react in joy or peace or sadness or heartache or anger. And they assume that their reaction is caused by the experience. Well, of course I'm unhappy. Look what he did to me. But he didn't do it to you. He did it, which is where he is. How you react is where you are. You may ask, what is happening to me? You are what is happening. Your consciousness is being made manifest. In books and other writings and lectures on truth, we often come across and hear the phrase, you are what you think. But this is not entirely correct. You are thinking what you think. You are not your mind. You have a mind, and the mind that you have is the mind also, the power to control the mind and to think what you want to think. This is the very heart of the practice of divine science. When you think positively, when you assert your spiritual strength, when you think about things not as they appear to be, but as you know they are in truth, there is an easy outpouring of good. But when your attitude is negative, listless, doubting, or bitter, you lose your chief source of power. You frustrate your potential. You inhibit the flow of life and substance, and you burn yourself up with your own self-induced poisons. It's good to take occasional inventory of your life. Look for repetition of problems in your work, in your finances, in your health, or in your relationships. For these things are obviously the outpicturing of your consciousness. Dr. James Porter Mills once said, disease, no matter by what name you call it, is always a disease of consciousness before it appears in the flesh. Consider this hypothetical situation for a moment. A man is laid off. The problem of the economy has led to curtailing an entire department of which he was the supervisor. The company decides not to keep him on in another department because of his age, but he is too young to retire and he's not financially prepared. Because of some unfortunate experiences in the stock market, he has little available assets. Unable to keep up the large mortgage on his home, he soon loses it. He has two sons who have to leave college to go to work. His wife, who has been living in a dream world of social prestige, is so angered at the prospect of being destitute that she leaves him. In the midst of all of this and the anxiety and the despair that sets in, the man has a heart attack and he is hospitalized. From his hospital bed, he literally shakes his fists at the heavens and cries out, "Why me, Lord? Why me?" He asks over and over again, "What is happening to me?" And the very difficult to take answer is, you are what's happening. When the man asks why God has brought all this painful experience to him, or at least why doesn't God put a stop to the injustice of it all, he is implying this is a heck of a way to run a railroad, and that if he were God, he would certainly do better, and he wouldn't fall down on the job like God has done to him. He would certainly set things right. But is he willing to realize that he is actually what's happening in his life? Though he is being upset by the unexpected is really a trap that he has previously set for himself. The classic question asked from time immemorial is, why do good people suffer? And why do bad things happen to good people? the only acceptable answer is they weren't good enough. This calls for a broader definition of the word good. In other words, good people may also be negative. They may be fearful, and they may be worriers. It may not be that they have consciously missed the mark, but that they have been operating on a wavelength of mistaken belief or limitation, even if only by fear or resistance. The person with otheritis is often lured into looking for shortcuts, get-rich schemes, and healing miracles. The one who works for a miracle is probably trying to bypass consciousness. But there are no experiences unrelated to consciousness, and there can be no permanent changes in a person without altering consciousness, changing the center of gravity. Our greatest need is to work for a change of our spiritual center of gravity, the level on which we live and have our being. We must change our essential nature, not just have an occasional experience of high consciousness. We delude ourselves if we assume that we can do this without discipline over a long period of time. If you have been thinking that you have had more than your fair share of challenges, the first constructive thing that you can do is take responsibility for yourself. Don't fall into a self-serving belief that something bad is happening to you as if it was coming from out there or somewhere else. Be willing to admit that you are what's happening. Your consciousness is being outpictured. Get busy working to get your thoughts on a higher level, to change your spiritual center of gravity. This is not to say that it is easy, but it is possible. It will take effort, and it will take much practice. But that is what divine science is all about. Shall we begin now to make this lesson practical? Will you please join me in our closing meditation? Please take a moment now to get comfortable. I ask you to close your eyes and shut out everything that is outside of this peaceful and holy place. Rest your feet comfortably on the floor and place your hands in your lap or at your side so that they don't call attention. And just relax for a moment. Take a deep cleansing breath and be still. Quiet your mind and let go of everything that is outside this peaceful place. Let go of any worrisome thoughts. Let go of any anger or any resentment. Let go of any jealousy. And just be still. Be still and go deep within to the center of your being, where our Father waits and welcomes you with his open arms, his unconditional love, and his peace. We are created in the image and after the likeness of God. We are sons and daughters of the Infinite Spirit, our Father, and source of every good endowment and every perfect gift. Created in the image of God, we are entitled to all the good of the Father. It is our birthright. Let us claim it now. To claim with joy our good from the Father, let us begin to move at least mentally and emotionally out of the ruts of so-called human limitation. With respect and love to our earthly parents, we can realize our heritage is not merely human. It is divine. This is a powerful realization. Once we accept it, we will enjoy the miracles of healing, prosperity, harmony, peace, forgiveness, and freedom. I accept that I am a child of God, entitled to the good of the Father. My inheritance is the wholeness, life, and strength of God. My inheritance is the love, harmony, peace, forgiveness, order, abundance, light, joy, and understanding of God. My inheritance from God is the kingdom of heaven, right here, right now. For the blessing of this awareness, O most gracious and loving Father, I give you thanks. Amen. The Lord blesses you and keeps you. He causes his light to shine upon you. He is gracious unto you. He lifts your consciousness and gives you his infinite, eternal goodness. Amen.